Our opening words this morning will be read by Sandy.
Thank you. Yes.
I just have to remark on that one announcement. Little Bee is one of the most intense books I've ever read. I may have to go to the book group. If you can't go to the book club, read it anyway. It's anti-war in its way. The opening words are these. Welcome to a day of hope and promise, to a place of peace and comfort, to a journey toward truth and justice, and to a community of love and courage that will help us along the way. The reading that I would like to share with you this morning is a poem written by extraordinary poet Marie Howe, H-O-W-E. She titles this Government. Standing next to my old friend, I sense that his soldiers have retreated. And mine? They're resting their guns on their shoulders, talking quietly. I'm hungry, one says. Cheeseburger, says another. And they all decide to go and find some dinner. But the next day, negotiating the two narrow aisles of the Health and Harmony food store, when I say, excuse me, to the woman and her cart of organic chicken and green grapes, she pulls the cart not quite far back enough for me to pass. And a small mob in me begins picking up the fruit to throw. So many kingdoms. And in each kingdom, so many people. The disinherited son, the corrupt counselor, the courtesan, the fool, and so many gods, arguing among themselves over toast, through the lunch salad, and on into the long hours of the mild spring afternoon. I'm the god. No, I'm the god. No, I'm the god. I can hardly hear myself over there muttering. How can I discipline my army? They're exhausted and want more money. How can I disarm when my enemy seems so intent? Sometimes using a poem for a reading can be a challenge because, of course, a good poem needs to be read several times before we can begin to understand its complexities and layers of meaning. I cannot say with any certainty what Marie Howe wants us to take from her poem, but to me, the poem speaks of how difficult it is for us humans, as individuals and as members of a community, how difficult it is for us to get past all of our fears and distractions and bickering and assumptions and habits and get to the heart of what it means to be human. I will get back to the poem in a few minutes, but first some reflections on war. When will the politicians understand that we are grown-ups, that it is way past time to use campaigns as an opportunity to talk seriously about the things that really matter? When will those running for office realize that we can take it being an adult conversation about the issues? When will they figure out that most of us want to tackle the big issues, but we don't know where to begin? 5 days after the 2012 presidential election has finally ended, what has changed? Did you hear any lengthy, complicated conversations, dialogues, even arguments about war during the endless months before Election Day? Did any candidate say anything worthwhile or relevant about how we might work towards ending war as a means of solving problems? If so, you can mention it in the congregational response. How sad. Especially because in our country, we commemorate Veterans Day. At the same time, we hold our big, important elections. As an editorial on October 29th in the Arizona Republic newspaper put it, yes, I hate to admit that I occasionally read that paper, it is perhaps fitting that we celebrate Election Day and Veterans Day so close together. How better to honor our veterans than by seriously discussing the problem of war? In late October, I was hiking in Zion National Park, a somewhat remote area. Several days went by without my having access to much news, though normally I am both a newspaper and political junkie. So it was with surprise and regret that I picked up a paper on October 26th and learned that George McGovern had died the preceding Sunday. As Joe Biden said in a tribute to McGovern, McGovern summoned public restlessness with the Vietnam War and helped bring about its end before so much more blood and so much more treasure would have been wasted. McGovern gave courage to people who didn't have the courage to speak up. He gave them courage to finally stand up. He stood there and took all of that beating because of his anti-war views. Biden concluded, "I want to know where the George McGoverns of today's world are." In 1972, I worked on the McGovern campaign. I shook his hand. My job in a small town in northwest Pennsylvania was to go door to door in a predominantly Republican ward. I did that with my then 7-year-old son in tow. We were invited into people's homes and had long conversations with folks. Watergate was just breaking. That ward went for McGovern by a fairly large margin, forever convincing me of the importance of giving people as much reliable, unbiased information as possible. Because I, of course, would never be biased. When I was in 9th grade, I met Karen, who had just moved to my hometown of Franklin, Pennsylvania. We became best friends, inseparable. We biked everywhere. Our favorite destination was Big Rock, Big Rock, overlooking the Allegheny River. Beautiful, beautiful spot. We would sit on that rock and talk about politics. We're 9th graders, 9th, 10th, and on. We'd talk about politics, current events, what was going on in the world. We had really good teachers, too. And we talked a lot about war. Our opinion about war, it was a stupid way to solve problems. We honestly believed that if we worked hard enough, we could end war. All through our high school years, I never stopped believing that. My college career began at American University in Washington, D.C., where I was accepted into that university School of International Service. I was going to go into the Foreign Service and be a diplomat. Now my friend Karen is a Jehovah's Witness. At least she was the last time I saw her, several years ago. And I am, well, perhaps a diplomat of sorts, but I am still convinced that we can end war on this planet. More than that, I am still convinced that we have to end war on the planet if we humans are going to survive. I participated in many anti-Vietnam War demonstrations. I went to the May Day protests in, pretty sure it was May of 1971. Marching in the streets might not be the most productive path to peace and ending war, though I believe there are still times when marching in the streets can be a useful tool. But I was beginning to think it's probably a better way, a more effective means of ending war. In the early 1980s, I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. The Cold War was still going strong. President Reagan told us that we who lived in the Bay Area could survive a nuclear attack because we would have enough warning, enough lead time, to allow us all to get into our cars and drive to Lake Tahoe or some such isolated spot in the Sierra Nevadas. This announcement in the Bay Area was greeted with much disdain and was the subject of many wonderful jokes. Clearly, President Reagan had never left the Bay Area on a Friday afternoon to go skiing at Tahoe. No way could traffic move fast enough to enable the entire population of the area to get out of town in 3 hours. The time frame the Reagan administration estimated we would need to get to a safe place in the event of a nuclear attack. Now that I think about it, this solution made about as much sense as the duck and cover drills I did in elementary school when we were supposed to dive under our desk, cover our heads, and presumably, thus be safe from nuclear annihilation. At about the same time, I was laughing at the absurdity of trying to get from San Francisco to the Sierras in 3 hours, I discovered an organization called Beyond War, an organization of which I have spoken before and will no doubt speak of again. Beyond War, which still exists, is a grassroots movement that began in California and spread throughout the country. Its goal was simple: to end war on the planet. Its two basic premises: war is obsolete, and we are all interconnected. You can see why, especially because of that second premise, it would appeal to a lot of Unitarian Universalists, and we did have a pretty large chapter here in Madison in the 80s and into the early 90s. I can't overemphasize the importance of this group. I don't have enough time this morning to go into much detail about it. I will say that we work closely with scientists and philosophers and psychologists from what was then the Soviet Union. I had the honor of traveling with one of these scientists around Wisconsin on a book promotion tour. I can't remember what I ate for breakfast yesterday, but I remember his name, Vladimir Agayev. Beyond War was responsible for the first, and as far as I know, the only book ever published jointly between the United States and the Soviet Union. The title of the book is Breakthrough. I think it's still available. I hope so. It was mostly essays by scientists and people who were, well, even some military people who made the case that we couldn't continue to wage war on the planet. I will never forget taking Vladimir to a big grocery store in the Wausau area, and he had never seen anything like the selection and the produce. And the sight of him biting into a Big Mac was, well, it was captured on camera. But Vladimir Agayev's hobby, remember, this man lived in the Soviet Union, he'd never been to this country. His hobby, about which he was very serious, was Native Americans. So in Green Bay, we were able to get several Oneidas to come and celebrate his being in this country with us, and they did many dances and I will never forget one of them going down and taking his hand and bringing him up to dance one of the Native American dances. So it's the people-to-people thing. I am convinced that one of the reasons we haven't destroyed ourselves yet is, at least through war, is because of people-to-people things. My son was a Rotary Club exchange student and changed his life. He's now does something in international studies at the university here and speaks five languages other than English fluently. So it's that. I'm pretty sure the Rotary Club program still exists, I hope.
Yeah.
And what's the other one? Great. My dad was a D-Day veteran. He didn't get on the beach at Normandy until almost midnight on June 6, 1944. By then, the beach was relatively secured and safe. My dad remembers stepping on the dead bodies and that the water was red with blood. To the surprise of myself and my brother and sister, my dad went to see Saving Private Ryan. He said the first 3 to 5 minutes of that movie are completely accurate. Like most World War II veterans, Dad never talked about the war until the last few years of his life, when I started going with him to France and England and Germany, both for the D-Day commemorations and because he wanted to try to retrace his steps, even to the place where he lost a leg around the Battle of the Bulge time. One February day in probably 05 or 06, when we were talking on the phone, he started telling me about a phone call he had made earlier in the day, one that he apparently made every year on this particular February date. He always talked to the nephew of one of his army buddies on this day. The army buddy and my dad had gotten separated from their unit somewhere in Germany in February of 1945. They were lost, cold, hungry. They hadn't eaten for 3 days. They were no doubt scared and confused. As they tried to make their way across rivers and through woods and find their unit, they stepped on a mine. My dad lost his leg. His friend simply disappeared, blown to bits in front of my father. He had never told this story to anyone in the family, not to my mother or my brother or sister. I had no adequate response. In May and June of 2004, I went with Dad to England and then to France for the 60th anniversary of D-Day. In England, we went to Stonehenge, because you have to go to Stonehenge. My dad's unit, had been over there in England for 18 months before D-Day. They were bored out of their mind. Sometimes they get passes to go into London, but London was, you know, being bombed, so that wasn't exactly a big treat. And they would eat their lunch some days at Stonehenge and sit down and lean up against the stones as you could walk all around. This trip, as you might imagine, strengthened my already strong belief that we have to stop fighting wars. Because a priest didn't show up in time, and because Dad had let it slip that I was a minister, which I would prefer he not do, then people treat you differently. I was asked to bless a Jeep, a World War II Jeep that was still sitting there in the sand on the beach. That was actually kind of fun, believe it or not, because I turned to the veterans, not my dad, but the other veterans with whom I'd established a connection, and said, "How do you bless a Jeep?" Which they thought was quite humorous, and they said, "Well, I guess bless this Jeep will do." That's pretty much what I did. The next thing that I was asked to do with my ministerial hat on was much more serious. I was asked to say a prayer at the end of the ceremonies on June 5th, the day before the ones on the 6th, of course. And suddenly, and I had 15 minutes, so I decided I wasn't going to say it in French and English, not 15 minutes. But there I was in front of hundreds of people gazing out at the rows and rows and rows of white crosses there on that hillside overlooking the beach. Some of you have probably been there, or you've seen pictures of it. And there I was, saying a prayer for peace. It was an interfaith prayer, but it was certainly humbling. So many lives lost and buried there on that coast, so much mourning to do. I know the arguments about why we wage wars. I know that we can't just suddenly disarm and send all our soldiers home. I am very grateful for our soldiers, and I tell them so whenever I see one. I know the world is a dangerous place, and yes, I realize that everything has changed since 9/11, and that fighting terrorists is not the same thing as fighting an army across the Flanders field in World War I, or landing troops on a beach in northern France. I know all that. And I know that some people make lots of money when wars are fought. And yet, I know that we humans can do better. I know that we have to continue to oppose war. Put all those arguments about why we wage wars up against the pain of losing even one person in war, and the arguments are senseless. I want to weep every time I see a list of the names and ages of the latest casualties from the Afghanistan war, if that's what we're calling it. Most of them are so young. From yesterday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Brandon L. Butry, 19. Dane T. Venny, 29. Ryan P. Jane, 22. And Brett E. Gornovich, 27. I also know that working to end war is exhausting, that it is easy to burn out, that it seems like an impossible task. Not too long ago, when we were talking about our current lives, my first ex-husband made some, we share grandchildren, so there. He made some disturbing remarks to me. "Are you still into that peace stuff?" he said. "You know, you're wasting your time. You'll never change anything." This man was there with me and our friends in Washington, D.C. in May of 1971, protesting the Vietnam War. "Have to get start on the 2016 campaign. I know, we don't want to hear that. We have to start the conversation with anyone who might conceivably think they're running. I am still convinced that we can end war on this planet and that we have to do this." In June in Phoenix at our annual General Assembly, I picked up a book by Unitarian Universalist minister Stephen Schick titled Be the Change. In 1969, when Schick was looking for a job in the peace movement, a man named Sandy Gottlieb told Schick, "What the peace movement needs are long-distance runners." Gottlieb was then the director of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy. Schick says that he didn't understand what Gottlieb was talking about. What did this comment have to do with ending the Vietnam War? I had to smile reading this. And Schick's next comment, "Now, 4 decades later, I realize what I didn't understand back then. Being a long-distance runner in the quest for peace and justice is an art. We need to understand ourselves to have some perspective on our work and our place in life. And we need to keep ourselves open to moments of grace and inspiration when they come our way." I smiled because in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and probably in the 90s even, into the 2000s maybe, I didn't get it either. It being the need to have perspective and patience while still retaining the passion it takes to be instruments of change. I was so impatient when I went to that May Day demonstration in the early 70s. I wanted the Vietnam War ended the next day. I was so convinced that my friend Karen and I would have the adults straightened out within a few years of our graduating from college. They would surely understand once we explained it carefully why war is, well, stupid. I didn't understand something else that is a crucial ingredient in working for peace. We have to cultivate peace within ourselves before we can be effective out in the wider world and in the long run. To regain perspective is itself a spiritual practice, says Schick. One that involves our awareness of the vast scope of nature and the far reaches of human history. From this wider view, we realize that change is inevitable. And we have to remember that we are not alone, although it often seems as if we are. Studs Terkel said something close to this. I wake up in the morning and read the papers and say the human species is not going to make it. Then, he continued, I run into people who are making a difference. We need to seek out the stories that remind us that we are not alone. Stories such as Wangari's and her planting of the trees. And somehow, we have to work through our fear of standing up and saying what we were trained to say in Beyond War. War is obsolete. We are one. We are all connected beings on planet Earth. As Albert Einstein said after the successful development of nuclear weapons, everything has changed except our way of thinking. It is difficult to change our way of thinking when we are fearful. We might have to change our actions as well. Somewhere in Colorado, on my drive from Arizona to Wisconsin last week, I put a bumper sticker on my car. The sticker says, Grace Happens. I have had the bumper sticker for a long time. I just didn't want to put myself out there by displaying it on the back of my car. Having that sticker there might mean that I have to be a kinder driver, one who doesn't say nasty words or do something with a certain finger when encountering an offensive driver, of which there sometimes seem to be so many. Back to the poem that I read earlier. At the very end of it, Marie Howe writes, I can hardly hear myself over their muttering. I think that means she is distracted from doing the work of the world. How can I discipline my army, she writes. They're exhausted and want more money. I think she's having trouble maintaining a balance in her life. How can I disarm when my enemy seems so intent? I think she is afraid of being the first one to step out of old patterns. Distraction and fear prevent us from getting down to the hard business of talking about war and how we can end it. So does failing to maintain a balance between our inner peace and the peace that we want to see in the wider world. But there is grace as well, and there are people planting trees and writing books such as Be the Change. There are so many people who came before us whose legacy depends on what we do, people such as George McGovern, and of course all those other people who are veterans. We owe them not only this brief remembrance on November 11th every year, but also our continued commitment to peace.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you.
For all the veterans, may the spirit of truth and love rule our hearts and minds and guide us into those ways that will create love, justice, and peace on earth. Go in peace and invite somebody to a potluck.